I'd like to start out by pointing out that a transhistorical phenomenon that we can notice, that is a phenomenon that happens in society, a diverse amount of societies, is a struggle for power. So we've seen this in ancient Indian epic poems and the 2008 elections. And I think that a logical byproduct of this is megalomania in the sense of obsession with power. So I'm not talking here in the sense of megalomania and a schizophrenic where he might think he's Napoleon, like a delusional power. It's just the obsession with and lust for power. It's a more general term. So I'll be discussing the incarnation of megalomania in the modern political sphere. But first, I start by defining power. And there are many definitions for power. And for example, there's Thomas Hobbes, who identifies it with wealth. But I picked Weber's definition of power because he's Weber. No,
because he has that power.
He has that power. No, because he really treats the term in isolation, and I think he captures its essence as opposed to saying what it should be or what it typically is accompanied by. And I read how he defines it. He defines it as the probability that one actor within a social relationship will be in a position to carry out his own will, despite resistance, and regardless of the basis on which his probability rests. So I think the most important aspects of this definition is the probability. So one doesn't possess power like you possess a dollar, like you either have it or you don't have it. It's either strong power or weak power. And the will, which is the important aspect of that, is that power isn't an end in itself. It's an end to carrying out the object of the will, so a specific end. And also the resistance factor, which implies that if there is an opposing force, strong power will prevail. So I did this with a comparative method of one ancient example and two modern examples. So the ancient example is Roman Caesar Caligula. There's a movie about him. Don't watch it. It's semi-pornographic. Just don't watch it. But I do recommend that you read the play by Albert Camus. Very good play. So I use him because I think he's pure megalomania, and I'll explain that. And he's a comparative standard, I think. And I picked two modern cases, one of a collectivistic society, as Professor Greenfield calls it, one of a civic individualistic society. And the one in the collectivistic society is Fidel Castro. And for the civic society, I picked the Christian right evangelical movement. So I wanted to pick something close to home. So I begin with Caligula. So he's famous for appointing a horse as a senator. He's famous for making statesmen kill themselves when they said they would give their lives for Rome. And for ordering a statue of himself to be erected in the Temple of Jerusalem. So, and the list goes on. But, you know, we could stack the list up and we wouldn't really get at his subjective motives. And I think a good interpretation of his subjective motives are brought alive by Albert Camus in his place. So you might be saying, oh, you're bringing literature into this, but it's not science, but I think he really does a good job of capturing the subjective motives of a megalomania, and I think literature can do that. And so I think I'm justified in doing it. Anyways, I'm going to read you a passage of a monologue in this play, which I think captures the essence of megalomania. So here goes. No, first he's talking to a person who's telling him that he's going to be killed. Then it's a monologue after the person. So anyways, so he says to the only thing I want, Elysion, is the moon. I know in advance that it will kill me. I haven't tasted everything that will keep me alive. That's why I want the moon. And I beg you not to show yourself here before you have got it for me. And then the person leaves and he says, no, even if the moon were mine, I could not retrace my way. Even were those dead men thrilling under the sun's caress, the murderers won't go back underground for that. Power to the uttermost, willfulness without end. Ah, I am the only man on earth who knows the secret, that power can never be complete without the total self-surrender to the dark impulse of one's destiny. I must go on until the consummation. Powerful. So, from this monologue, I extracted, I'd say, 2.5 basic characteristics of megalomania. One is the end of the will, which in this case is the will itself, the consummation of the darkest. When I say the will here, I mean like the Freudian will of the darkest corners of the human psyche, just unleashing that. So that's why I think that's a purest form of megalomania. So the will acquires primacy over anything, even death. So he's willing to die in order to bring about his will. Now remember Weber's definition of power, carrying out one's will despite resistance. So the carrying out of this will acquires primacy over any ethical hindrance or even death. And the end of this will also acquires a quasi-divine character, I call it. So it's like, it is a certain secret about the universe. Recall he calls it, he's the only man on earth who knows a secret. So he's the only man on earth who knows that that true happiness and power lies in the consummation of your deepest, darkest corners. I don't know where he gets that idea, but that's his idea. So there's this sentiment that you know a secret that no one else, or that is constitutive of the universe and that should be brought about via your will. So that's a comparative standard that I use for the modern cases. And I begin with Fidel Castro. And it's important to point out about him because of his biographical circumstance of being brought up in a nationalist, setting his identity as a Cuban nationalist, combined with the historical fact of the rise of Latin American anti-United States of America radicalism, that because of this he emerged as a Leninist. And I say that this ideology of Leninism has ingrained within it these characteristics of megalomania that I described. So if you think about the primacy of revolution over any hindrance that comes upon revolution, it reveals that both in Lenin's case and in Castro's case, this was very much present. In Lenin, I thought about the Kronstadt Rebellion, where he killed proletariats who rebelled against him in the name of the revolution. So it leads to this kind of contradiction whereby any hindrance upon your end is unethical and deserves to be destroyed. Just like Caligula said, I will destroy you if you don't bring me the moon. I will destroy anyone who doesn't. It's a hindrance upon the revolution. And Castro shares this sentiment because he regressed to the political oppression of the regime that preceded him in the name of a revolution, in the name of killing counter-revolutionary or neutralizing counter-revolutionary forces. And in terms of a divine entity that the megalomaniac thinks he's in touch with, I think this sentiment is ingrained in the Hegelian historicism or dialectical materialism that they both, well, Hegelian historic, then that version of that, that they endorse. And this teleological vision of history gives that sentiment that no matter what, I will be correct because, as Castro's works, the title of his works reveal, history will absolve me, or nothing can stop the course of history. So history is kind of this predetermined force that will absolve all these unethical actions. So, check, they share the correct characteristics with Caligula. And then in terms of a Christian right movement, it was harder to pin this down because they don't necessarily follow a strict ideological line like Marxism or Leninism. Rather, they're kind of a fusion of disparate ideologies. But I thought like these disparate ideologies were basically, you could pin them down with American exceptionalism and Christian moralism. So, by American exceptionalism, I mean the sentiment that the society that was revealed to be the best society by John Locke and then brought about by the founding fathers is the correct society and should be implemented across the world to improve the world. So it's not just sympathy with democracy, it's the belief that democracy is the only legitimate form of society. And Christian moralism, similarly, isn't only sympathy with Christian morality, but the sentiment that Christian morality is the morality and the only legitimate form of morality. So this, again, shares those characteristics with Caligula, because if you look at the policy that's implicit in American exceptionalism, which is higher military spending and aggressive foreign policy, like as was seen by Reagan's funding of the Contras or his Star Wars model, or in Bush's case, the war on Iraq. Any hindrance upon the ethics of democracy is seen as legitimately worthy of being neutralized. And any hindrance upon democracy is seen as unethical, let's say. So, but this isn't quite enough. There's also the notion of moralism, which again, any hindrance upon Christian morality is seen as unethical and worthy of destruction. And I think it's interesting that not so much on the side of moralism, but on the side of exceptionalism, the right meets with Marxism in that they embrace a kind of historicism. I think this was most notably seen in Francis Fukuyama's, is that how you pronounce it?
Fukuyama's
essay, The End of History, which embraces this Hegelian spirit that history is moving towards a certain end and that history will eventually legitimize and render true the sentiment of American exceptionalism. So that's more or less the line of my paper in the presenting the comparative part. And then I do another comparative part where I see what's exclusive to the modern instances of megalomania, but thus is not characteristics of the Caligula. So I see what is all-inclusive but exclusive, therefore definitive for modern megalomania. And I think the two basic tenets of that are that it's distinctly collective and distinctly ideological. So I wouldn't say that these these movements are characterized by megalomaniac people, but rather a gathering of people that form one megalomaniac entity. Perhaps a better case of this that I should have put into my studies, the Jacobins. I think they're the prototype of a megalomaniac movement, in that it's a big entity in which the individuals form the megalomaniac. It's not that, like, Louis XIV was a megalomaniac. So, but it was too late when I realized that, so I didn't include it in my paper. And the second aspect is the ideological aspect, which you can say isn't necessarily exclusive to modernity if you take it at face value, because the Crusades, for example, were deeply ideological. But I think the distinguishing characteristic is that it's a secular kind of ideology. It's an ideology on what this world should be. This world should be a democracy, or this world should be a international communist. And it's not about the kingdom of God. It's not about salvation. And it's not revealed word. It's not like a word brought down by God. It's a word brought down by Karl Marx, or a word brought down by John Locke, which true acquires the status of a Bible, but isn't regarded. It's regarded as coming from a man, not from a divine entity. And I also do a comparison between Fidel Castro and the Christian right to see what is exclusive to each. To each movement, to see what is exclusive to a civic society and what's exclusive to a collectivistic society. And I think the distinguishing feature here was that civic societies have a political structure that's made to prevent this kind of phenomena where a radical megalomaniac takes over. It has this advantage in this sense that there's checks and balances to take to prevent this, but in another sense, it has a disadvantage in that cases of megalomania become more imperceptible. So I think this is what happened in Germany's case when Hitler came to power, that since the megalomania comes to power through legitimate channels, he doesn't come to power through subversive guerrilla warfare or through a coup d'etat, then it's a more imperceptible phenomenon because you don't necessarily see it happening in such a blatant way. So and the last question I addressed was whether this is a mental illness or not. So it was really hard. It was really hard to answer this because these are the people who integrate these movements are characterized by a very strong identity. It's not what we have identified with as mental illness, because they have very strong conviction and a very strong will. So perhaps this can serve as a lesson about how too strong of an identity is bad. I don't know. So take that however you will. But I think it's more important to examine whether it's a social illness rather than an individual illness. And I think this is also similarly a twofold answer, because in one sense it's a cure to anomie, because it gives people a direction and an identity. But in another sense, it can end up regressing into the absolutism that modernity is supposed to combat.